Welcome to the Behavioral Health Collective podcast, a community of behavior analysts who are passionate about sharing evidence-based practices from the perspective of behavior science. We connect families and educators to information that promotes robust behavioral health in the home, community, and classroom. We are behavioral health practitioners who empower parents and caregivers by sharing behavioral resources that are current and evidence-based. At the Behavioral Health Collective, we set families and educators up for success by promoting meaningful and lasting behavioral health and skill development in the children or young people they work with. Thank you for listening in today. I'm Erica Ng, the founder of the Behavioral Health Collective. We know that trauma has very little to do with what an observer might perceive to be traumatic, but has everything to do with how an individual perceives an experience. As parents, our children are often in the hands of other caregivers, whether this be at school, camp, extracurriculars, respite, or babysitting. Even when we're with our children, experiences can happen that an adult may not perceive to be traumatic for that child, but ends up affecting them in an adverse way in the long run. Perhaps you're a foster parent of a child with a long trauma history that involved repeated experiences of witnessing violence, neglect, or abuse. If you parent young children or children who have limited language skills, knowing how a child was affected by an experience may be extremely challenging at best. I think any parent would find this conversation interesting, and it will at least hopefully create a better sense of empathy for families that have experienced traumatic events. I first heard today's guest at the BCABA conference in early March 2020. Alexia Stack is a behavior analyst who specializes in taking a trauma-informed approach to her behavior analytic work. She presented her research into current evidence-based resources to treat trauma in individuals with autism. This is a really powerful session, I recall. She currently has her own behavior analytic practice called A Block Above, serving a very wide variety of clients, and did her master's thesis on treating individuals with autism who had experienced trauma. In her paper, she points out that there's a lack of research in this area, but presents a modified treatment design based on trauma-based CBT, which is a well-established, evidence-based trauma treatment for a typically developing individual. Alexia has been in the field of behavior science now for 20 years. She has a wide breadth of knowledge and an innovative spirit to seek out the best possible treatment models for her clients by becoming skilled in this area of trauma-informed behavior treatment. I'm really excited to speak with her today and share this conversation with you about her work in trauma-informed behavior analytic work. She will also share more about her use of acceptance and commitment training, also known as ACT, which we'll refer to both as ACT and acceptance and commitment training in the podcast, and also sharing her approach to treating trauma and working with families. So here we go. I will introduce you to Alexia Stack. Hi there, Alexia. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing today?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today. I'm just really excited to be speaking with you about this area of trauma and just your background. So thank you for coming to share your expertise with me.
Thanks for inviting me. I feel super honored to be here. So it's fantastic.
So I guess let's get right into the questions. So mm-hmm. I guess just to introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners, how did you first get really interested in trauma-informed behavior science in particular? So you are a behavior analyst, but how did you get into this niche in particular?
Yeah, so I think that there are several pieces that kind of, I think, came together in a timely manner or sort of coincidentally at the same time for me. First piece was I was working with different families on my caseload who had both known and unknown trauma occurring in the home and in the community at the time. So the kids that I was working with were pretty unique in how they would respond to different like behavioral interventions and practices. And in particular, I noticed when, you know, they were asked to do certain things in their sessions, they would run away or pull away or escape, whatever words you want to use around it, in ways that were really different than most of my other kids. So they would, you know, sometimes they would run and curl up into a tight little ball, which was pretty different than some of, you know, the other learners that I had been working with over the years. And sometimes they would run and hide under furniture, and they were completely non-responsive to, you know, typical redirections and typical ways in which we would get kids to come back to work and get them responding to us and so on. And so they looked like they were more freezing, almost, if you think about like a fight, flight, freeze response. And sometimes even they would verbalize what was happening for them. This was pretty evident that they were experiencing flashbacks in those moments. So, which, you know, I don't know exactly what I was doing when I was asking a child to, for example, like do some math questions. And all of a sudden I'm hearing about, you know, some experience that had happened in at school that was not related to math necessarily, but probably the fact that I was asking about math then triggered some sort of a flashback and trauma response. So, you know, those behaviors that I would sometimes think, oh, well, they're just trying to get out of what I'm asking them to do, didn't look the same, basically. Mm-hmm. So they presented really differently. And I had several kids like that all at the same time that I was working with. And, you know, the other thing at the time is I was at that same time along all of that, I was learning a lot about my family's history in the Second World War and kind of its effects on us as a family and what gets passed down and what gets carried down in terms of family trauma histories and so on. Mm. So, you know, that just kind of opened up the door and developed some curiosity around people's lived experiences and life stories. And then that just kind of naturally extended to the families that I was working with at the time. And then also, you know, I was interested in going back to school and completing a PhD at the time. And so I started to just read, or I started to look for readings in our field specifically of a behavior analysis as it relates to trauma and autism. And I found that there was just really nothing out there at all at the time. And even, you know, several years later, there's very little literature in this area as applies to kids with developmental disabilities. So kind of all those things together put me forward on this path of wanting to learn more and write and present and all of that. So, yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. It was a perfect confluence of lots of different things. Yeah. So do you currently serve some clients with autism? Do you also have clients that do not have autism, or have you worked with some of these kids in the past? And then also, I guess part of that would be, do you take foster families or have any contracts with, you know, our Ministry of Child and Family Services?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of my clients, like you said, are on the autism spectrum, but oftentimes they'll have multiple diagnoses or like comorbid diagnoses as well. So their autism may not be like the prominent reason even necessarily for why they may be coming to seek services. Like I often will have a family who might have a comorbid diagnosis of like ADHD, for example, with autism. And oftentimes even like kids will get an autism diagnosis because autism and ADHD can look really similar to one another in certain learners, right? So, you know, that will sometimes happen. Or I work sometimes with kids with pervasive demand avoidance as part of their diagnosis. Sometimes like families come to me with genetic disorders, and oftentimes there will be that, like I said, that diagnosis of autism built in there. And I think that comes down to funding issues. And you know, a lot of these disorders present themselves in really similar ways. And sometimes kids also have opposition or are labeled with, I don't like to say have, or, you know, they're given the diagnosis of oppositional defiant disorder along with their ASD as well. So that's kind of the caseload predominantly at this time. But I've often had parents call me seeking help who don't have any kind of diagnosis, and they're looking for behavioral supports for their children. Yeah. And, you know, in terms of the ministry and contracts and so on, I happily would work with families who have children in foster care, but I don't have specific contracts with the ministry. I somehow managed to keep really busy without that in place. So I can't imagine, like, it would be lovely. It would be great, but that's not the way that my practice is set up. So
fair enough. Yeah. Yes. Capacity.
Yeah, exactly.
Capacity. Yeah. Totally. So you're saying that some of the diagnosis, like although a client would come to you with autism, you're saying that some of the challenges that are being presented are maybe coming from a different diagnosis that they have, is what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah. 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 And even like what we know of trauma is that trauma can look a lot like ADHD, and trauma can look a lot like autism as well. And so sometimes, you know, those things are overlaid and you have comorbid symptoms happening from the, from who knows which actually, really.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So I guess, could you give us a bit of an idea of what sorts of families, or situations families find them in before they come to you, like when they're coming to seek services, like what kind of challenges are they observing at home and the community potentially?
I mean, a really big one, like away, stepping away from the autism stuff. What I've had a lot of people coming to me with are repeated stories of, you know, my daughter is, or my son is 3 years old, 4 years old, and we've been kicked out of this many daycares or preschools. And so they're getting removed from those kinds of child care environments because their behaviors are intense and they don't have a formal diagnosis or anything like that. And so people don't know how to provide the right kinds of supports and so on. So that's occurred pretty frequently. And, you know, sometimes it'll be a matter of years before they are kind of sent in the right direction or before parents are really strongly encouraged in order to go get a formal diagnosis. They're often, parents are often really at the end of their ropes and they're really stressed out. And kind of almost like in a state of desperation for some kind of support and some kind of help. And a big variable that kind of steps in the way really quickly becomes a funding issue, actually. So, you know, it's they might be directed in the right way by somebody that they've come across in the community that says, hey, you should probably really go find somebody who specializes in behavior and behavior supports and so on. But then they come looking for that support and they very quickly actually find out that they don't have the funding, they can't afford it. And then I think they don't really know what to do. So,
Yeah, I mean, you've touched on really what the goal of this whole endeavor of the Behavior Collective is, you know, is just creating better awareness and hopefully down the road, better funding for services, because, you know, it sounds like a lot of families are coming to you and then not having the funding there available, which is such a hard conversation, I can imagine, to have with a family to say, like, you know, these are the costs of services, but it not being available there.
Yeah.
So just a quick question as well about how you advertise your services. Do you advertise that you do work with a trauma-informed lens specifically, or that you take clients who have a background of trauma? Like, is that part of your service?
Yeah, so I do actually advertise specifically that we work within a trauma-informed framework and trauma-informed practice. On my bio, it's specified that I have developed a subspecialty in that area as well. I don't advertise per se that, you know, these are the clients that we take on or the clients that we specialize in, but our website's needing some updates and some changes to it anyways, and so I'll be adding some specific, like, bullets or points around, you know, for example, providing acceptance and commitment training as part of my practice and specifying, you know, families who have, or for children or even youth and adults who have, you know, histories of trauma, for example, but the adult is an individual client on the autism spectrum, for example, so that there would be multiple reasons for why they may come seek supports and services. Yeah, I've noticed more and more that people are like kind of narrowing down how they advertise or promote their behavior analytics services. And I'm kind of late to that party a little bit right now. So yeah.
But obviously, yeah, obviously very specialized. So that's great. That is, will be out there, I suppose, on your, on your site as well. Now, so when you are taking in a client who does have a trauma background, could you walk us through what your intake process might look like that would be different from a typical intake process for behavior services? Or have you kind of, you know, merged it so you're covering your bases, you know, whether someone has a trauma background or not?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in some ways it's merged and in some ways it's different, and it really varies from client to client. Like, there's a lot of flexibility, but, you know, if the if there's like a known history of trauma and the parents openly talk about it and they will readily and happily share information with you, then the process is always pretty much the same at this point. It just, you know, I'll get to it in just a second, but how much information I gather will vary a little bit from client to client. But when that history of trauma is openly spoken about, there's a level of acceptance there on the parents' behalf and so on, I'll ask them to provide, you know, the diagnostic reports that they may have, any school reports, any kinds of counselor or psychological reports and so on that they might be able to provide as part of just kind of developing a really general assessment plan introductory. A really big piece is having a really high level of flexibility. And the reason being is that many of the kids and teens that come to me who have that history, the biggest issue and the biggest hurdle to overcome initially is feeling safe and developing a trusting working relationship. If you imagine, well, this family is maybe ultimately hiring me to teach some academic skills or some life skills or some social skills and provide them with maybe a family positive behavior support plan. But if I can't get past relationship building in the first 3 to 4 appointments that would typically be part of my, you know, assessment process, then I come out of that, well, I have that relationship and that rapport now, but I don't really necessarily yet know what that client can do. So it can be really tricky. I've had, for example, like situations where I've literally spent like 4 appointments in the matter of a couple of weeks that are a couple to a few hours long. And all we've really done in that time, and I'm not meaning by all in such a way as to minimize it, it's actually a really big deal. So if you have a client who has a really complex history of childhood trauma, then those 4 appointments, being able to have, establish any kind of safety and security with you know, another adult being present and stuff like that is a huge like thing to establish and create and overcome in a lot of ways. And so I may not know, for example, what that teenager can and can't do after those 4 appointments, which is really different than when you kind of program within just like, here's your little 3-year-old who has a diagnosis of autism, or here's, you know, same thing, but now we're like 8 years old, for example, and we have a diagnosis of autism that's come a little bit later. It can be very different, you know? So here I have, these are all my treatment goals. Here's my treatment plan. And here is like, oh, well, now you'll willingly sit with me for an hour. But, you know, again, because of funding limitations and all those different pieces that are part of this puzzle, you know, well, we get along really well. And now maybe I can start to ask you some things about what you know or what you can do and things that you can't do and assess those different skill areas. So I've had lots of cases where it's like, okay, well, I've just used up 8 hours of time and resources, but this is what I've done in that time. And from there, I have to develop a treatment plan that's kind of essentially taking the things that I learned while establishing and developing a relationship and putting them into a program. And then from that point forward, a lot of changes will happen. And, you know, maybe the learner's program is like not at the level that they're at, but then we make lots of changes on an ongoing basis afterwards.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So that's kind of what it ends up, what it can look like, you know. And then other kids, like maybe their trauma happened early in life, but they have one secure, really stable parental figure who's really established like a good solid ground and a safe ground at home for them. And so the assessment process might look a little different. Like I might have to spend then less time with that particular child establishing rapport and establishing a good relationship. And then I can actually start to go into like a language assessment or go into a life skills assessment or go into a behavior assessment and so on. So it does require a lot of flexibility really at the end of the day.
Yeah, no kidding. Mm-hmm. So it's very, tailored to the needs of the client there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then if like somebody comes to assessment and I assume it's going to go, you know, in this like very linear fashion, and then suddenly something comes up and it's not, you know, and I suspect something else has happened in that learner's life, then again, I adjust and I change what I'm doing based on the assessment process. But that almost tends to happen less. Like many families are very forthright and very open about histories.
That's great. So very flexible intake process, it sounds. So then from there, can you describe a little bit about your treatment model, maybe that for a family or a client that has experienced trauma? And then what are some of those considerations you might be taking into account in that situation?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that in general, I've kind of touched on it, is that everything that we do as part of our treatment model is, my whole practice is built around providing trauma-informed care at this point. So whether a family comes to us with a known history of trauma or an unknown history of trauma potentially or no trauma whatsoever, a lot of the different components of how I set up programs and treatment. And for us, you know, it's not treatment in the sense of like a psychotherapy or anything like that, like behavior analytic treatments, right? But it's all, there are lots of different components that will be the same across the board and across the different families that I'm working with in general. And then each, you know, if the family does have a known history of trauma, then there might be some things that are idiosyncratic to that particular family and team and needs and so on. But yeah, there are many components. So like I said, like I was touching on with the assessment piece, the first piece is making sure that we have safe and trusting working relationships with the child client or the adolescent client. And that's across the board kind of for everybody, that we have strong therapeutic alliances with the parents as well. Another big piece to how I develop and set up programs is to teach my learners that I'm working with that when they withdraw assent, so when they say in some way, whatever it is, no, I don't want to be doing this right now, that gets honored and reinforced always, so that the client's voice, the learner's voice comes first above and beyond whatever might be on my own agenda in terms of like teaching and instruction and stuff like that. And yeah, it would be ultimately great if all of my kids say, hey, you know, this, I really don't want to do this thing today. But oftentimes that might look like, you know, pulling away from the table, starting to engage in some sort of like more aggressive behaviors and so on. And those withdrawals of assent are honored. And then we start to focus on like really calming down and emotion regulation strategies and so on. And then we come back to work and come back to those tasks and goals, but we don't work through, we don't push through any kind of, you know, learning circumstances that might be aversive to the learner. That's a really huge piece.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. And then like as oftentimes as behavior analysts, they might ask, well, doesn't that just reinforce escape maintained behaviors? And we definitely take data on everything that we do so that we can make really good database decisions around those things. And sure, if that's happening, then we adjust what we're doing. But more often than not, it actually leads to just, again, it leads to an environment that teaches the child that my voice has meaning and, you know, I can say no, I can have an opportunity to calm down and regulate, and then I can get back to this thing that maybe I wasn't enjoying doing in the moment.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I guess having that component of teaching that, like the teaching opportunity of the self-regulation and emotion awareness, you know, that's so powerful that, you know, I'm sure at some point they do start learning that as a skill and able to identify.
Yeah, they absolutely do. Yeah. And yeah, that's actually its own like component as well. So it's withdrawals of assent. And then what do we do with that when we say that we don't want to do the work? So, you know, also a big piece is understanding the nervous system. So this is where I really step out of behavior analysis and understanding the nervous system's role in learning and how it gets affected when a client has experienced trauma, because the body gets affected by trauma. So that's something that is a part of my practice's trauma-informed perspective. And yeah, the emotion regulation piece is a big piece as well here. So we work on things like co-regulation with kids who don't have co-regulation skills established yet. So that's really where an adult who's calm and who's steady and has regulated themselves helps the child that we're working with complete the cycle of regulation. And then eventually we move towards, you know, self-regulation through a lot of different mindfulness practices to build those abilities and skills. So
that's awesome. Actually, I just want to, one thing that stood out there was when you said with the co-regulation, having an adult that has regulated themselves, and that is so important. And I've experienced that myself in those like moments of frustration, or witnessed that with, you know, whether it's school staff or, you know, other environments I've worked in. But you're so right that that is a key piece of the adult being able to be regulated in order to do that co-regulation piece.
Yeah. So, I mean,
thanks for mentioning that.
Yeah. Like if we think about, we're kind of, we are socially wired, right? We learn from our social environment. And so before we can be expected to self-regulate, infants, babies, you know, toddlers, they're all co-regulating with their primary caregivers. And not everyone is able to do that. And sometimes you have kids who, you know, they can't self-regulate, but they also are still needing to co-regulate really. So there's, you know, we work on things like teaching our clients to name their own feelings. A lot of kids who come with histories of trauma, they are not really attuned to themselves. They can't necessarily name their own internal states. A big thing also that happens is they often will misattribute the emotional states of other people as well. So they might always think an adult is angry when that adult actually just feels fine and they're okay, for example. But their own trauma history sometimes teach them to process emotions differently. And another component is like working on establishing, building strong alliances with other professionals that are responsible for clients' care. So I don't do any of this stuff on my own without the support of psychologists or social workers, counselors, school staff, school personnel, who are all really part of the child's team. And they have typically more education and more knowledge and understanding than I do in these areas. And their voices are really heard as part of the development of plans. So that's a really big piece for us as well.
Wow, that's great. I really respect your perspective on that, because I think sometimes we get a bad rep as behavior analysts of, you know, coming in and seeming like we know it all, but to just hear you reiterate that, the importance of collaboration and understanding different perspectives and understanding knowledge and respecting that knowledge of other disciplines that we're working with. It can only have the best outcomes for a client if we're working together. So thank you for mentioning that.
For sure, yeah.
So also in terms of other alliances, can you tell us a little bit more about your work with parents in particular? And I know that you are an ACT practitioner. And so how do you implement ACT in your work? Is that directly with parents? Is it also with clients, both one or the other?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I'm going back to school, so that I can do more work directly with parents from an ACT perspective. So like when we look at ACT as a therapy versus the way that behavior analysts are, you know, basically allowed to work with it within their scope of practice, I'm really hoping to be able to apply it and use it in both ways in the more near future at this point. So in terms of applying it with the families and with my clients and so on, we do a lot of work around values and moving in the direction of values. But those are oftentimes like my youth client values or the child's values, as well as the parent's values as well, and just kind of setting up the environment so that whoever we're working with is going to actually come into, I guess, contact with like those things that should allow those behaviors to continue more and more in the future, I guess, without using too much technical jargon right now, which is something I often tend to default to. No, but so there's a lot of values-based work and setting up and arranging the environment so that we can actually practice that and be successful with it and do it more and more, basically, because we have been successful with it. I do a lot of work in present moment awareness and mindfulness practices. Like that is for sure within the realm of behavior analysis. And I do lots of that work with kids, youth, adults as well, and the adults being the adult client with autism, for example, and present moment awareness practices are a big piece versus things like, you know, diffusion techniques, which tend to fall more within the realm of a counselor or a psychologist or something like that. Like those are things that I tend to kind of stay away from because those really focus on thoughts and stuck thoughts or what they call fused thoughts within ACT training. So yeah, I mean, that's how I apply it at my practice, and I get supervision presently in that area, so.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, it's exciting that you're going back to school and we'll have that, both of those avenues, I suppose, you know, to be working a little more with parents and more of a counseling component alongside the client, because it's true. I mean, our model is very different from someone taking their child to a counselor where they're working the child and there isn't necessarily that parent training component, but that's amazing that you already can implement some of that with the values with parents. So,
and I mean, the other areas are like developing parent positive behavior support plans, like so things that really come straight from the PBS literature, but that are rooted in a trauma-informed practice, the development of safety plans as well. So things like that are also a component of our practice, understanding what kinds of environmental triggers bring up flashbacks and stuff for clients. And so we do a lot of work in that area as well, not in order to treat the trauma, but actually in order to prevent flashbacks from occurring in sessions and stuff like that. So it serves, you know, I don't want to be inadvertently triggering my clients and so on. And so that involves working with the parents and working with the children as well and developing plans around that also. So
that's great. I'm glad you mentioned that because that really just makes it seem like you made that clear that like we're not treating the trauma, like that you're working with other professionals on your team. But I think you're so clearly describing how a behavior analyst can fit into that broader team that is supporting a client and bring something really important to the table, but also being within our scope of practice. So
Yeah,
I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah. I'm also just thinking for listeners, I should have, when I asked you the question, I said ACT, but you had referenced this earlier, but I'm going to connect to them that ACT is acceptance and commitment training. So I should have mentioned that when I had asked. So I guess just to start wrapping up, how can we be doing a better job in either here, British Columbia, Canada, or more broadly, but in serving families that have experienced trauma and whose children are going through some behavioral health challenges of some sort. So when those things come together. So yeah, do you have any perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty big question. There's a lot of different things. So I mean, there's a funding related issue, and then there's like, well, what can we do as behavioral scientists? And from a funding related issue, I really do feel so strongly that, you know, having provincially funded mental health supports for kids and their families is the only way that this is going to be accessible for everybody. You know, I am firmly a believer that mental health should be treated like physical health. You know, if I break my arm, I have a physical trauma, I just go to the ER and I'm cared for, I get a cast and I go along my way. If I have a broken sense of trust with people because I've been emotionally, physically, sexually abused, I've been neglected, there's no, you know, provincially financed support available for that. And so, you know, then that has its own huge set of consequences in the long run, right? We have kids who become teenagers and adults who suffer and struggle with depression, anxiety, you know, suicidal ideation, addictions, and all of that kind of stuff. And so really, ultimately, those people who can access mental health services, whether they're, you know, provided by a behavior analyst or they're provided by a counselor or a psychologist, those families tend to have the financial resources in order to be able to provide their kids with support and treatment. And so we end up with really a two-tiered system when it comes to mental health services. So that's one big piece. And the other big piece is working towards behavioral sciences and us as professionals, as behavior analysts, being more approachable by the general public and population, being more palpable to other professionals and families as well. Oftentimes, I think our persona is such that we come across as being abrasive or harsh or know-it-alls or unwilling to work flexibly with other people. And that's been something I think that's been, I've been working in the field, I think over 20 years, somewhere in that area right now. And that's, I feel like that is, has really haunted my entire career in some ways, where I really wish that more of us would learn to present ourselves in such a way that we're seen as people who can provide, you know, care and treatment and support, because many of us are super capable of it. But I think we get really caught up in the rigmarole of the science in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So we're just not very consumer friendly, you know, and lots of people have been criticizing us, and we're starting to criticize ourselves for that now. But there's a lot of work to be done in that area.
Yeah, so, you're right. Yeah, I feel like things are starting to, like, we are starting to be a little more self-reflective is, is kind of the sense that I get. But you're right, there's work to be done. So
yeah,
glad you mentioned that. So yeah, I guess we're just about to wrap up. But is there anything else that you want to include that I have neither asked you about, or that there's maybe a resource you want to share with families before we finish?
Oh, I think that, you know, I could probably share some resources that maybe you can add to the podcast link afterwards.
Yeah.
That would be great. And what was the first part of your question again?
Any other insights that you might have, or things that I haven't asked you about you wanted to touch on?
I think I've pretty much touched on most things. You know, I think the biggest thing is to really know that, you know, for a lot of people, there's a lot of darkness, I think, around trauma, but really there's a lot of light and there's a lot of hope when you work through it. So rather than, you know, not seeking help, not seeking support, trying to kind of hide, push it away, pretend like things haven't happened for your child or for your family, but actually moving in the direction of stepping forward and seeking support when you, where you can find support is really ultimately going to lead to a lot of positive life changes for many people in the end. So yeah. Wow,
that's a great way to wrap up. Thank you for that wisdom. And I just really appreciate you sharing your insights here and the incredible work you're doing, Alexia. So thank you for the way that you're serving clients and blazing this new trail with serving clients with a trauma-informed practice. So thank you for that example to us as behavior analysts and for serving families that way.
Thanks so much for the opportunity to speak with you today. It was really lovely. So.
The comments and views expressed in this podcast do not constitute or replace contractual behavior analytic consultation or professional advice. Views expressed are solely the perspective of the speaker and do not represent the views or position of their colleagues, employer, or other associates. Please seek out a behavior analyst through the BACB website if you would like to receive further behavior consultation. Until next time, take care.